primarily for the book of Nehemiah, that have been a tremendous help and encouragement to me over the last 3 or 4 months in seeking to face the challenge to live by faith in my own life. And I really got into this study as a result of a sort of crisis of faith that occurred about 4 months ago as we were facing the decision about taking over, well, I suppose more than 4 months now, but the decision about Ghana, of taking on this extra responsibility for Ghana. And as I was praying about this and I felt the need to respond, I could see logical reasons why I was being asked, and I knew some of the background and the circumstances, and it seemed right as far as I could see, but I just found myself paralyzed in, I suppose, by fear, really, and I don't understand all of my emotions in it, wanting to do what God wants me to do, not really being, you know, clear what I should do, or how would I know when I'm sure that it was right. And feeling so lacking in confidence or trust that it also began to affect my thinking ahead, my planning and my work in what I already had. So that I would sit down, I remember one morning very clearly sitting down in my study, needing to write some letters and do some other things for preparation for a trip to Nigeria, and feeling I needed to give Jim some response about the Ghana thing, and just feeling a funny, you know, I couldn't settle to anything. And my mind filled with doubts about whether or how did I even know that what I was doing was right. And maybe 2 years ago when we couldn't get into Nigeria, the proposal was turned down, you know, maybe that was God trying to, you know, and well, you know, you get into that sort of thing, you know, there's no way you can reason yourself out of it. So I went to the toilet. And as I walked in to our bathroom, there was a little text above bar church, text for the year, just hanging up above the toilet. And the text was this, Haggai, work for I am with you. My spirit remains among you. Do not fear. And it was amazing, an amazing experience, because God just took that truth and applied it to my own life, and it just all vanished. And all the doubts and fears of the apprehension disappeared. Now, that was a crisis experience, which we all have from time to time, don't we? And God used his word to awaken faith. And that started me off on this study, because I was so encouraged part by that I began a little study in Haggai, and then that led me to Ezra and Nehemiah, and now I'm actually in Malachi. But these thoughts that I want to share are really from Nehemiah, because over the last few months, it's as I've got into this, and I've looked into Nehemiah, and I've seen this man's faith, that I've been heartened to give the kind of leadership in my own job that I need to give. And that's, all of us are in positions somewhere or another of giving some kind of spiritual leadership, I felt that these thoughts that have encouraged me might encourage you. And I'll start by reading from Nehemiah chapter 2, 11 to the end of the chapter. I'll use this as a launching point to go back into chapter 1 and forward into the rest of the book. So Nehemiah chapter 2. And this is really the sort of the point where Nehemiah actually comes face to face with the task that God has called him to, and it's the crunch point in the book, if you like. What will actually happen when he gets there and he sees the work that God has called him to do, and he's faced with the challenge of motivating the people there to tackle the task. I went to Jerusalem. That's just four words, but it took about 5 months. I think if you read Ezra carefully, it's about a 5 month journey. And we easily just sort of gloss over that, but it was a much bigger task and much more frightening one than it ever is for me to go to Nigeria. And in fact, many of the promises that we claim for our work today, promises prophecies in Isaiah, if you look at the context carefully, they were first given for the encouragement of men like Nehemiah and Ezra, making this trip back from the area of Babylon, which they'd been deported, back to Jerusalem to rebuild. And if you study Isaiah carefully, you'll see that that was the context in which these promises were first given. God says to the people, yes, you know, don't be afraid, I will raise up Cyrus, my servant, and he will restore, and the remnant will return, and when you pass through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you, and through the fire, you will not be burned. And their promises that in the first instance are given to hearten these descendants of Abraham in the task which they face, the difficulties that they face. And we, as also heirs of Abraham, share in those promises, as Paul makes clear. But in the first instance, I believe that many of those promises were given to hearten men like Ezra and Nehemiah as they returned. And a lot of it just to cope with the fears and dangers of this difficult journey, four or 5 month journey. So I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night I went out through the valley gate toward the Jackal Well and the Dung Gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem which had been broken down and its gates which had been destroyed by fire. And I think that as I studied this, this is a recent breaking down of the story, not just the original one by the Babylonians, but if you read back in Ezra, the early chapter of Ezra, you see how they started to rebuild. They rebuilt the temple, they started to get things going again, and then in Ezra 4, when you read how some of the local people, just before Ezra and Nehemiah's going up, the local people got together, written a letter saying there's going to be a rebellion, and the king had said, saying, the work must be stopped. And then it tells how the local people, presumably the same people we read about here, Sanballat and Geshem and Tobiah and people like that, had all come and destroyed what had already been begun and burned down the gates and so on. And I think that's the reason why we read of Nehemiah's interest when they come from Jerusalem. He wants to know what's happened, not what happened 100 or so years before that, when the city was first destroyed. What's happened recently? And so there's been recent discouragement. And I wonder how Nehemiah felt as he went out and he looked at what needed doing. Examining the walls of Jerusalem which had been broken down and its gates which had been destroyed by the fire. Later on he describes it as a great task, not in the sense of just an important job, but as Kidner brings out in his commentary, the original meaning of that verse that we often quote in 6:3 is that it's an enormous task. I've got an enormous job on my hands. How can I leave it? It's an enormous task that needs to be done. As he looks at it and he surveys the wall. And then I moved on toward the fountain gate of the king's court. There was not enough room for my man to get through. You remember, if you've seen pictures of Jerusalem taken from the Mount of Olives, the Kidron Valley is very, very steep at the sort of, as you look at Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, at the sort of left-hand end. There's a very, very steep drop into the valley. And the wall is right up against that drop. And so, as he comes around that sort of southern end of Jerusalem, he begins to move up the walls looking at it. He finds he can't get through, there's not enough space. And so he has to go down into the valley. So I went up the valley by night, looking up the side of the Kidron Valley at the walls where they'd been broken down and destroyed. I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. I wonder how he felt as he was looking at it. How he felt whether he continued to have absolute confidence that God had put it in his heart to do it, and he was going to succeed, or how the people would respond when he put it to them. There were battles of faith there for him with that. I went up the valley by night, examining the wall, finally I turned back and we entered the dung again. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests, or nobles or officials, or any others who were in the way. And then comes the crunch. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in? Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon them and what the king said to me. And they replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. They went to Sanballat, the Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite official, and Geshem, the Arab, heard about it. They mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? And I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success, and we, his servants, will start rebuilding. And as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem, or any plan or historic writing. And then chapter 3 tells about how Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work, and then everyone offered. And the whole situation was completely turned around by this one man. And I asked myself, now why did Nehemiah have such an impact? I mean, weren't there enough people there already? And couldn't they see that the walls needed rebuilding? And Nehemiah was miles away. He was in Susa, the capital. Why did someone have to come all the way from there? Why did some of these local people say, oh, you know, we want to get going, we must... What was it about Nehemiah that was different from the others? What made him the leader? Well, as I studied this, and I thought about this, and I wrestled in the light of my own life, what can I learn from the life of Nehemiah in fulfilling my role as a spiritual leader, and the work that God has called me to do, and what God has put into my heart to do? What will make the difference? And the two big things that stood out to me as I looked at these two verses, 17 and 18, of chapter 2, are first his concern, and then his faith. See, everyone else could see the trouble. In fact, they were in a better situation to see it than Nehemiah was in Susa. But they could see it, but they were accustomed to it. You know, well, it's always been a bit like this, you know, Jerusalem, and, you know, I guess we just have to, you know, it's not really as we'd like it to be, but, you know, that's the way things are, and, you know, we just, that's it. And there wasn't a concern. They didn't feel it. But how different is Nehemiah? When even in Susa, hundreds of miles away, he hears, and it breaks him down. And there are two great aspects of Nehemiah's concern here. Well, first, just let me make a point about the link between concern and faith before we look at his concern a little more. As I thought about this, I thought, well, walking by faith, but faith isn't, I don't think faith is a motivation. I don't think faith motivates you to do things. I think when you're motivated, faith enables you or encourages you or allows you to move forward to accomplish. But there has to be a concern and motivation to want to do something that then gives rise to the need to believe God. Think of the man in Luke 18, the last part of Luke 18, the blind man, at the edge of the outside of Jericho, and he's shouting and crying out, he hears that Jesus is coming, and he says, you know, son of David, have mercy on me. And they bring him to Jesus, and Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? He says, I want to see. He was concerned about his own state. He wanted to be different. He wanted things to change. He wasn't happy to just settle for things as they were. And that led him to want to see Jesus, to exercise faith. And Jesus says to him, your faith has made you well. So faith and concern, I think, go together. And often if we're not walking by faith, we're not conscious of the need to, often. I think it's just lack of concern. Now let's look then more carefully at Nehemiah's concern. And I think the two words that stand out to me from verse 17 are the word trouble and the word disgrace. I'm looking at the NIV there, but whether those exact words occur in the Bible, the thought is there. You see the trouble here. Now, if you look back in Nehemiah 1, you can see that Nehemiah, right from the time we first meet him, is concerned about the people in Jerusalem. So when his brother comes, he questions them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile. And they said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province, and back in the province are in great trouble. And it tells that he wept and mourned, and he prays, and he says, let your ear be attentive, and your eyes be open to the prayer of your servants, praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. And verse 10 of chapter 1, they are your servants, and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. And it's interesting that the testimony he has with Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem as he returns in chapter 2, verse 10, is that they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Now, Nehemiah's concern, as you follow it through these two chapters, starts with asking. He's interested to know about them. And then it touches him, their state touches him, and he weeps, we're told, and he prays, and he plans. And then he takes initiative. And then he goes. And then he identifies, notice in verse 17, this is a tremendous verse, and it's not you see the trouble you are in, but you see the trouble we are in. This concern led him to identify them, and then he helps them. And the action, the going, and the identifying, and the helping them springs from the interest, the concern, the prayer. Now, it's something we could spend a lot on, but this type of compassion, this type of concern for people, this ability to feel where they are and enter into them with it, I believe is one of the great motivations of the Christian life, which lead us out to trust God. I think if we study any of the great men of God, passing of Hudson Taylor, why was he a great man of faith? Why was he even in China? Believing God in his great things. Because he has such a great concern for people. I remember seeing the film Nicholas and Alexandra. I'd recommend anybody seeing. I heard the film for about 3 weeks afterwards. And it was one of those films that I vowed I would never go and see a film like that again. But one incident stood out to me. It was when the Tsar was being taken back across Russia after being captured. He was talking with a naval captain or something who was, you know, was trying to understand the Tsar. You know, why did you do all the things you did? And they were talking, and this naval captain became more and more frustrated with the Tsar, and trying to explain to him how the things he'd been doing had caused so much hardship, and the Tsar just didn't seem to be able to see it or understand it. And the man ended up by saying, he says, you're not a bad man. You've just got no imagination. And I think that's often true of us too. It's not that we're bad. We don't sort of wish harm on anybody. But we've just got no imagination. We're not able to see and think and feel what other people are saying and doing. And we become so hardened by all the sort of stuff we see on the telly and this sort of thing that people's needs don't touch us. Now, Nehemiah was more touched in Susa about the needs of the people in Jerusalem, which he couldn't see, than the people in Jerusalem were being right there in his head. And I feel that if we're going to walk by faith, we need to ask God to give us a greater compassion for the needs of people around us that will prompt us and motivate us so that we need to exercise faith. Because otherwise it's too easy to just be comfortable in our own little citadel in Susa and never have to step out into the world to really face up to the challenge of the harassed and helpless, the sheep without a shepherd, and not to need to exercise faith. So the trouble, but I think that we would misunderstand Nehemiah greatly if we stopped with that. Because the second word that I mentioned to you here is the word disgrace. And I think that if his concern for the trouble of the people was a great motivating force that drove him on to walk by faith, I think this sense of disgrace or shame is an even greater one. And I found this hard to understand when I first started looking at it, because it seems to revolve around Jerusalem. So when he inquires about the remnant in chapter 1, he also, I ask him about the remnant that survived the exile, but also about Jerusalem. And then they say about the people in great trouble, and the disgrace of the wall of Jerusalem is running down, the gates have been destroyed. And when the king asks him why he's looking sad, he doesn't say, well, because my people are suffering. He says, because the city of my father's house is moving. And he talks in chapter 2, verse 12, about, I have not told him what God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. Now, why this great concern for Jerusalem? Well, I think as I studied and thought about it, it became clear to me, and it's obvious, really. Chapter 1, verse 9, he refers to Jerusalem as the place, in addressing God, and quoting God's word, he says, the place I have chosen to dwell in my name. And for Nehemiah, as for any believing Jew at that time, Jerusalem was associated with the name of God. God had promised Solomon, this is the place that I will cause my name to dwell. So in the Psalms, you get this tremendous preoccupation with Jerusalem. Psalm 137, if I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand with her. And this sense of the shame and disgrace which comes out in Psalm 74 is another one where it talks about how the heathen destroyed Jerusalem, and even the plague of the sanctuary, the place where you cause your name to dwell. And to Nehemiah, the fact that Jerusalem was in ruins, God's name was dishonored among the nations. And to him, that got him, that touched him. Now, I feel that I also need a greater concern for God's glory. And I don't, whatever the international Zionists may feel, I don't feel any longer that God's name is particularly associated with Jerusalem. I think the teaching of the New Testament is that God dwells among his people. That the temple of the Holy Spirit is the people of God. 1 Corinthians 3:16. That we know that we are God's temple, and that God's Spirit dwells in us. And that I understand that the you there in that verse is plural. That God's people are where God dwells. That our bodies and our fellowship, our interaction, that the Christian church, if you like, is the dwelling place of the Spirit of God. And we bear the name of God. God has caused his name to dwell. We bear the name Christian. And it's in roots, isn't it? Someone told me that they felt that the main reason people weren't turning to Christ in Britain, the main obstacle to people coming to Christ, was the church. Well, it's easy. It's always been like that, we just accept it, like the people nearby stuff, it's a shame it's like that, and we sort of come to terms with it in our minds, but I don't think we should.
I think we should have a concern for the glory of God. And we should want to see things turned around. See, I think when if we don't, we just accept it as it is, and we can do our own little bit in our own little way, be happy with that, and we don't have to exercise a great deal of faith. But if we face up to the challenge of the world in which God has put us, and with a real concern for God's glory, then, and I believe, as I'm sure we all do, that we, as a group, have a tremendous amount to offer. That many of the reasons for the weakness of the lives of so many Christians, and the weakness of the church in our own land and in other lands, that much of the solution lies with the things that we emphasize. And that God has entrusted to us. And that we need to believe God and step out of a concern to see Him glorified and to see people helped. And to be willing to believe in the big things. Well, there's a concern. I've taken far too long on that. But Nehemiah's great concern for people and for the glory of God led him to walk by faith, because there was no other way that he could come to terms with these concerns. And so, verse 18, I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me, and what the king said. And that's a statement of faith, that he couldn't see God's hand, you know, sort of big thumb and four fingers. It's a statement of faith, isn't it? I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me. And you don't get the impression that Nehemiah was trying to believe it. You know, sort of, try and imagine or somehow believe that. But that he really did believe that God's hand was upon him. And I think that it's this confidence, perhaps more than anything else, of God's commitment to what he's doing, which enabled him to motivate the others. I answer them by saying that God of heaven will give us success, and we, his servants, will start the building. You sense that he believes it, and you want to go with it. And faith, I think, is perhaps the greatest recruiting force. I noticed in Ezra, when I was studying that, in Ezra 7, the end of that chapter, the last verse. Because the hand of the Lord my God was on me, I took courage and gathered leading men from Israel to guard with me. Now here was Ezra. He gathered leading men who were influential in their positions in Babylon, Susa, and that area. Men who were already successful. And he managed together to go with him that long journey. Remember, Ezra didn't take part in that school. And he had a lot of money with them, and a lot of bandits. You know, and he managed to get these leading men to go with him. Why? Well, he says, because the hand of the Lord my God was on him. I took courage. And I think that when we believe God, we believe that God is committed to what we're doing, and that his hand is on us, we can take courage from that, to take others with us. And just an aside here on the student ministry. It's an observation that I've had that I've not really had as much opportunity to test as I'd like to, but I throw that as a thought. I think one of the keys to a fruitful student ministry is that there are students in positions where they're trusting God to do something. See, often I noticed this when we were in Southampton, that we had the ministry so that the people who were trusting God, who felt the responsibility to believe God to do things, were the people off the campus. And so the students that we were working with were just waiting for everyone else's faith, and, you know, follow their happy followers, But it was when it was when men on the campus felt the responsibility to believe God to see things happen, that then people around them were attracted and were drawn to them, and they were able to take the lead there with them. They were able to get people building because they were believing God. And I think that's the biggest factor in spiritual leadership, that we believe God, that we believe God's hand is upon us, and we're able to take their rights. Now, as then I thought about this sort of faith, and I thought about why did Nehemiah have this kind of faith? How does it show itself through the rest of the world? And I'll just mention a few things you can ponder through. One of the things I notice is in Nehemiah 13, according to my great love, the very last verse of the book, we'll never be with the same man. I felt sort of uncomfortable, you know, it's a man sort of a bit preoccupied, you know, with what he's doing. But then I realised, no, I've completely... The thing is that to Nehemiah, the most important thing was what God thought of him, was God's evaluation of him. He was a man who was sort of preoccupied with what God thought about what he was doing, and he wanted God to be pleased. That's exactly the same idea as Hebrews 11:6. If anyone wants to please God, he must believe that God is, and that he rewards those who seek him. And Moses, we're told in Hebrews 11, that the reason that he was able to endure the anger of the king and to make the choices that he did was that he looked to the reward. He was preoccupied with that. And Nehemiah was a man of faith because he was preoccupied with God's evaluation of him. And that's a thought that's been tremendously helpful to me over these last few months. Because when I have people sort of trying to wrestle with what other people think I should do and what everyone else thinks about it, then I've stopped leading. But when I concentrate on what God thinks of me, and what God thinks of the decisions I'm making, when I'm looking by faith, my decisions are motivated by the unseen God and by the future reward which he's promised to those who serve him faithfully. Another thing about Nehemiah's faith, he had convictions about the word of God. And, you know, I don't need to dwell on that, but it's an interesting little study in the book to notice how it comes through in the way they handle the word, and the word of God is a central place in this book. That there was a conviction that it was the law which God had commanded Moses. It was a God-inspired scriptures that they were concerned with. It's quite a different attitude to the attitude that you find among the kings prior to the destruction, though there are one or two exceptions. But it's quite noticeable. Convictions about the word of God. And then his prayer, of course, and more than any other book apart from Psalm, Nehemiah's book, concentration on prayer. And that's surprising as I thought about that, but maybe someone can set me right. I think more of Nehemiah is devoted, there's more on prayer in Nehemiah. You know, sort of comparative to the length of the book. In any other book apart from Psalms, of course, which is all prayer. Pretty much the whole of chapter 1 and the whole of chapter 9 are devoted to prayer, and throughout the other chapters, constant prayers. And I asked myself the question, did he pray because he had faith, or did his prayer lead to his faith, or did his faith lead to his prayer? I said, now, am I going to become more of a man of faith by giving myself a prayer, or is the fact that I'm praying because I'm a man of faith, you know? And I thought this both, isn't it, really? That, you know, in the book Walking by Faith, there's this illustration of a man stepping out of the lake, you know? And I don't have very much faith, you know, but you remember that picture? Well, I think that's how it works, isn't it? That what I take as prayer is a step of faith. I mean, prayer is nonsense if you don't believe that God is and that he rewards those who seek him. And so as I pray, I take a step of faith. And that leads me into an experience of faith and the trustworthiness of God. I think that's what happened in Nehemiah. I think his concern, he had faith, he had enough faith to turn to God. his concern led him to express that faith in prayer, and there's a whole train of thought from there. And that's where I need to start. You see, I don't know whether you're like me, but I look at Nehemiah, I become sort of bogged down the enormity of the steps of faith he took, and I can't sort of identify with that. And I you know, I'm faced with situations and people and concerns with people around me, maybe where I live, and concerns for work in Nigeria and in my areas of responsibility, concerns in my own life, and I just don't know how to come to terms with them, but if I start by prayer, I think the lesson of Nehemiah is that as he prayed, he persisted in prayer, God led him into other steps of faith. And his prayers became more specific. You read chapter 1, he starts off, his daily journal, and ends with a very specific prayer, so he might have favor in the sight of this man after that. And then he found himself in a situation, he prays to the God of heaven, he says to the king, and the whole thing's happening. But it starts with prayer. And then the other thing on his prayer that encouraged me is that it's full of short prayers. Now, maybe that's a cop-out, but I'm one of those people that Ian Barron's book, Power Through Prayer, just leaves me paralyzed. I several times tried to go away and have sort of a few days of prayer with God, and I read bits of that book, and I just ended up in sort of total defeat and preoccupation of myself and my failure, and I'm not like that. And yet Nehemiah brings me a man who's a practical man, who's out doing things. I don't think that when he was mourning and praying and fasting in the first chapter that he stopped doing his job. I get the impression that he continued his job, and he was doing it, you know, on either end of his job and in between. And that he was a man who was taking everything of God as it came up in his life. And though I need to work on giving myself to longer periods of prayer with God, that I can work on prayer in my life now, today, this minute, now, you know, as I'm speaking, by learning to take every detail of my life to God in prayer. That's been a tremendous help and encouragement to me as a practical lesson of this faith. And then his conviction that God was guiding him, what God had put in my heart to do. I struggled, one of the struggles I had was the fact that I know I'm a sinner, and I'm aware of things that are wrong in my life, and I start thinking, well, how can I be confident that God's guiding me if I know that there are things, you know, wrong? And of course, I was thinking on that one day, and Psalm 25, 14 just came right into my mind. It was Psalm 25 earlier, 7 or 8. Good and upright is even therefore he instructs sinners in the way. And it's vital to my leadership, isn't it? And to our leadership, to have confidence that God has put into our hearts to do it. And that we believe him and we trust him for that. His faith is shown in the way we handle opposition and difficulty. And that's been a help to me, especially in the context of our situation in Nigeria. And the great thing that struck me is he didn't let it sidetrack him. He didn't become preoccupied with solving the difficulties and get distracted from the job. And for 2 years, of my role in Nigeria, I gave most of my thinking and praying and their energies into solving the difficulties of the quota and the visa and everything, to the neglect of the work. But I'm more and more convinced from Nehemiah that we just need to keep doing with the primary task God's given us to do, concentrate on the work that God has called us to, and believe that the lines are changed. You remember a Christian going to the hill and all this progress? He comes to Rome, there are lines on the side, and you know, the faint heart is, it turns back. But Pilgrim remembers, Christian remembers that the evangelist has said, if he keeps the path, he'll be all right. So he keeps going, as he goes, he finds the lines are changed. That's just what Nehemiah found. He says, God has frustrated their plan. And as he went forward, he saw that the powers of evil and darkness and opposition around him had been frustrated by God in a chain. It was only his faith to continue and press on with the task God had called him to, despite the difficulties, that enabled him to experience that truth. But he stuck to the task. And then his hard work. And faith and hard work, faith and works are often contrasted, aren't they, because of the problems that have arisen in the church over the doctrine of justification. And yet, Nehemiah is a tremendous example of James 2. That faith and work rather go together. And there are so many practical illustrations of that from Nehemiah. I prayed to the God of heaven and I said to the king, the God of heaven will give us success and we his servants will rise and build. So we prayed to our God and we posted a guard against them day and night. Remember the Lord our God is great and terrible, and fight for your brothers and sisters in the house. And this tremendous bringing together of faith and hard work. Not a sort of passive faith, waiting around for everything to happen, but throwing ourselves into the task that we're doing with the utmost diligence and energy, confident that knowing that only if God helps us can we hope to succeed. And discovering God does help us. And we can do far more than we thought we would with the help of our God. And his work, you know, one of the things that attracted me in as I get bogged down in my workshop is his planning. He's a thorough planner. His organization, he organized by. His paperwork, you know, look at Nehemiah, one of the most boring parts of the book is it's full of lists. Okay, someone had to write that down. You know, that I think was one of his strengths as a leader. He was, you know, I used to think, well, some people like that, some people well organized and have things written down, you know, and I now have something to do, that's just hard work. And it's an area of faith, really. To believe that God can help me do it. I sit there, I've got a prayer letter, and I can't do it. And I think, no, I can. With God's help. And I can do it far faster than I think I can. With God's help. I pray. I say, Lord, just my mind is blank, just help me, not pick up my pen. And God helps me. But I sink under my workload. And the things I have to do, if I don't believe that God can help me, I feel, I really identify, this is just my last point, I really identify with Nehemiah 4:10. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, the strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. And verse 12, then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, you can't do it. That, you know, one group of people coming and saying, look, it's too retired and there's so much to do and can't do it. And the other group coming and saying, well, you can't, you know, whatever you do, 10 times over. And God says, what? Why would you? Yes, the concerns are great. Yes, the challenges are enormous. There's so much to do. Work, for I am with you. My spirit abides in you. Fear not. Well, I hope the Lord encourages you through some of those sources he had made. May the Lord help us to really trust him and to accomplish and attempt far more than we could do if it wasn't for him. We're going to return to prayer now. And what I'd like to suggest you do is just as you are, where you are, turn around and form some groups of that. I think that's six.